worshipped. I want to be loved.
I've told you a million times not to talk to me when I'm doing my lashes.
Oh, it's you. I didn't know you with all your clothes on.
You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view.
What am I going to tell you? You look like a woman.
Well, girls, looks like it's back to the perfume counter for me. And by the way, there's a name for you ladies, but it isn't used in high society, outside of a kennel.
Hey there, welcome back to the Gold One Girls podcast. We are your hosts, Meredith and Amelia, and we thank you for joining us today. We're really excited because we're going to talk about a topic that is something of a passion for both of us, and that is going to be the history of movie palaces in Los Angeles, specifically the ones on Broadway. So we're going to basically just jump right in on that. So I wanted to start off really quick before I hand it over to Amelia to discuss the particular theaters that she wants to discuss today. I just want to give a brief history of the movie palace in general. So in my like research, I actually found a conflicting history on like when the actual first movie palace was created. I found that some sources said that the Regent Theater was acknowledged as America's first motion picture palace, which that was opened in New Jersey, Paterson, New Jersey. And I also found it was either 1913 or 1914. This also is conflicting information. The other sources I saw cited the Mark Strand Theater as the first movie palace. So I think it was one of the two. And I wanted to find a definite answer, but I was like, you know what? I'm going to put both of these down because I don't want to say the wrong thing. Now, basically, the culture of the movie palace was really interesting because obviously movie theaters had started out, you know, as Nickelodeons, and they were a lot more low-key. And so by the 1910s, you know, basically they all wanted to up the ante, all these people who designed the theaters, and they were like, well, we want to make it an opulent experience. And it kind of like the quote unquote legitimate theater, like opera, you know, opera houses and things like that. And so you started to see the designs become very ornate. And it's a very interesting thing to study and to see how it all happened. So now many of the studio heads and architects and film exhibitors were first generation Americans. And some of these were like William Fox and Samuel Rothfeld. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly or not. And their experiences as first generation Americans definitely would have given them a unique perspective on the American consumer culture and how that was coming about as movies were starting to boom. And then basically most of the great palaces were designed and created by three architectural firms, Rapp and Rapp, John Eberson, and Thomas Lamb for the Big Five studios, because of course the big studios in Hollywood owned these palaces. And so it became kind of a competition for a lot of these designers to be like, okay, who can make the most grand movie palaces. So this was a big thing for a little while. And a lot of them were inspired by European grand architecture. And they were like, hey, the more the merrier, let's do it up all the way to the nines. I liked taking a quote from a website called dobywood.com. I like this. It says that everything about the movie palace was designed to make the average citizen feel like a celebrity, a millionaire, or royalty. And in larger, and also I'm going to quote from the same website. It says, in larger towns, it was common for more than one movie palace to be built, and it seemed where multiple theaters were, there was a very healthy competition to make the next theater bigger, better, and more over the top. Even in small cities and towns where there was no direct competition, lavish theaters were erected where citizens had never seen such opulence. While not true palaces, these theaters were an important part of American culture. In the smaller towns, movie theaters became cultural centers for their societies. and societal life began to revolve around what was going on at the theaters. In addition to the movies, the theaters would be rented out for special events such as school graduations, traveling lectures, community theater, weddings, and church services. And of course, this really went on mostly till the 1920s. And when the Great Depression hit in 1929, it took a big toll on the palaces. And theater attendance dropped from 90 million per week in 1930 to 60 million per week 2 years later, when the Depression was at its worst. And during the same period, the number of operating theaters fell from 22,000 to 14,000. And theater managers had to trim their own operations just to keep the doors open. The first thing to go was the live acts, which, of course, live acts became very popular in between movie showings. And they soon learned that by making the program shorter, they could have more than one show a night, which meant more revenue. And the standard evening program had a newsreel, a cartoon, perhaps a short special interest film, previews, and the feature. And the weekend matinees would commonly add an episode of a serial adventure, such as Buck Rogers films, Flash Gordon, Roy Rogers, and Tarzan and Dick Tracy. So backtracking back to sort of when the palaces were in their beginning stages, by 1916, there were more than 21,000 movie palaces in America. And the theater most Americans attended was, quote, an architecturally ornate center of the community's social life, in the words of David Rosenberg for Slate. Movie palaces played an important part in creating and sustaining the golden age of Hollywood, which many say had its apex in 1939 with Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz and other great films of the year. During the Depression of the 1930s, many went to the cinema to escape their difficult lives. Sitting in those opulent surroundings, watching stars whose lives were shaped by the studio to appear incredibly glamorous, viewers must have felt like they were watching royalty, an impression the studios that ran Hollywood encouraged. So again, like going back to just the discussion of what, you know, what did movie palaces contribute to the movie going experience? Like, I think it's just an interesting thing to look back on. And it's just, I don't know, it's just like very fascinating to look on that. So with that being said, I want to go ahead and throw it over to Amelia, and she has chosen several old movie palaces in Los Angeles to discuss.
Yeah, so I think one of the great things about this topic is that Meredith and I are both pretty passionate about it, and thanks for being my friend, Meredith.
Thank you for being my friend.
Wow, friends till the end. Isn't that a Hannah Montana? Oh, yeah. True Friends by Hannah Montana. That describes us pretty well. Mm-hmm. Never forget that banger.
No.
So the reason this kind of topic came about was recently, not last weekend, but the weekend before, I went on a self-guided tour down Broadway, the theater district, and went and stared long at multiple theater marquees. To all the old theaters. And so most of the theaters that we're going to be talking about, their marquees are still around, and some of the interior of these theaters are still around. And it was just fascinating to kind of like also peek in through the gate that they have to not have people come up to it and try to, like, you know, because they're all closed. And I was just like standing behind the gate like, let me in! That's literally how I felt. And, you know, I really love movie palaces, and I would die to go see a film in a movie palace just because of the experience. And I kind of treat almost every film experience like I go to a movie palace, because I like to dress up and I like to put on makeup and I like to go with friends and just make it be like a really big experience, because I want to make it so much different than it is when you're watching a film at home. Like, I really want that unique experience. And so it's really cool that some of these theaters actually still are around and exist. And when the pandemic is over, I hope that we can go into some of them. And to be fair, like, I've gone to a lot of different theaters, and like, I will make it be a movie palace experience for myself, like even if it's like a dumpster fire of a theater, because I've been to some dumpster fire theaters before. So some of the movie palaces that I saw while I was on my walk, and by the way, for people who are in LA, I think a lot of classic film people who live in LA already know this, but the LA Conservancy, a really great organization, does walking tours and some virtual tours now because of the pandemic, but they do a walking tour through the historic theaters. But I think because of the pandemic, you can't go in any of them. So it would actually just be like walking by them, which I'm like, I can just do it like from the apartment any day I want. I want to get into them. So hopefully at some point the LA Conservancy will be able to do some tours that are, you know, inside the theaters for the ones that are left. So the first theater that I saw on my leisurely walk was the Warner Brothers Downtown Pantages Theater. So it is now a jewelry mall. But before it was a jewelry mall or a jewelry emporium, which I've never heard about in my life until I moved here, was that the theater opened on August 17th, 1920 as the Pantages Theater, not to be confused with the one on Hollywood Boulevard. And it featured vaudeville and feature films, and it had a 1920 style architecture, and it seated like 1,750 people. That is a lot of people. It is huge. And there's a lot of weird scandal that happened with the Pantages that I think was really hard to detangle when I was reading about it. But the man who built it, Alexander Pantages, was propositioned by a prospective buyer named Joseph Kennedy to purchase the theater. And Alexander was unwilling to sell Joseph Kennedy the theater. And Kennedy decided to use some ruthless business tactics in order to secure the theater from Alexander. And so Kennedy hired a woman named Eunice Pringle to frame Alexander for rape. So here's a quote about that situation. On August 9th, hey, that's my grandpa's birthday. unrelated. On August 9th, 1929, in Pantages' flagship theater in downtown Los Angeles, a hysterical lady in red emerged from the janitor's broom closet on the mezzanine screaming, "There he is, the beast. Don't let him get at me." She pointed to the silver-haired Alexander Pantages in the office next to the broom closet. Poor Pantages was convicted and sentenced to 50 years, but the verdict was overturned on the appeal on the basis that it was prejudicial to Pantages' to exclude testimony about the morals of the plaintiff. The court found her testimony so improbable as to challenge credibility or credulity. Credulity? God.
That sounds right.
The girl, Eunice Pringle of Garden Grove, California, told police that she had come to Pantages looking for work as a dancer. Instead of offering her a job, he had pushed her into the broom closet and wrenched her.
Like, hit her with a wrench? Wrenched
her underwear loose and raped her. What is wrenched?
Was it, like, spelled like a wrench, like W-R?
Yeah.
Okay, hold on a second. Actually, that might be something. Oh, okay, nope. So we've learned a new word today. I don't know. I didn't know this. So, actually, according to my handy-dandy Google search, looks like wrench means to pull or twist something or someone suddenly and violently.
That makes sense. At the trial, Pantages' lawyer proved that the attack would have been impossible given the small size of the broom closet. The jury also shown how athletic Pringle was and that she would have been able to fight off Pantages. The theater was purchased by Warner Brothers and in 1929 was reopened as Warner Brothers Downtown Theater with a two-strip Technicolor Vitaphone feature, Gold Diggers of Broadway. The theater closed in 1975. It was a church at one point. As of today, the main lobby and auditorium are now a jewelry emporium, like I said. So the thing with Pantages is actually like, he didn't lose the theater because of the crime, like of his charges. Apparently he was already losing money on the theater before that, But it certainly doesn't help to be charged 50 years for rape, to really lose a business. And he was acquitted, and her testimony was not credible. And it's interesting, though, because actually he was charged later for like soliciting minors or something, or underage girls. So actually, you know, in the end, he wasn't a very good person. But it's a beautiful theater. I went into the theater, you know, well, I'll call it the Jewelry Emporium, because that's what it is. And I swear to God, I've never seen so many people want to buy jewelry. I did not understand it. I was like, jewelry is the most uninteresting thing to me, unless it's like skulls or like spooky jewelry. But just regular jewelry is like so boring to look at. I can't imagine shopping in a giant mall for it. So what I did was I just stood where the actual auditorium was, and where the stage was, because there were as many dealers down there. And I just stared at the architecture, because the beautiful mural ceiling is still intact. Like, the boxes are still there. The balcony is still there, although the seats are ripped out. And you can see the windows for the booth. And it's just so beautiful and incredible. And I'm like, I really wish I could see a film there. And I really wish it wasn't a jewelry emporium. But all the people who were selling jewelry were probably like, what is she doing? Why is she like staring off into like nothing, the abyss? And like, is she here to buy jewelry? Usually you're not supposed to take pictures, but I took pictures of the two exits on both sides that had the Warner Brothers logo on it. And it is just so beautiful, every part of it. And the security guard was asleep, so he didn't notice. And I finally left after, like, I think an hour of staring. And I will definitely be going back, because it's like a 10-minute walk from where I am. And the next theater that I saw was the Rialto. And it still has its really beautiful marquee. It looks great. It was opened in 1917 by J.A. Quinn. It's a neoclassical style building. And it was equipped with a theater organ, which I thought was really freaking cool. Because watching a film with live organ is amazing. And it was purchased by Sid Grauman in 1919. And it was bought by Paramount Public Theaters after that. And then it was bought by Fox West Coast Theaters, then Sol Lesser's Principal Theaters Corporation in 1941. And the great thing is it switched to showing Spanish language films in the 1970s. And it's funny because I asked my mentor Gary, I was like, he said, oh, I've been to the Rialto. I watched Jurassic Park there in Spanish. I'm that's like, that's amazing.
That's cool.
Eventually, it was closed in the 80s, 90s, and late 80s, 90s, and early 90s. And then in 2013, it opened as an Urban Outfitters store. And it's really odd to walk up to a theater marquee and see that Urban Outfitters is playing every night, every day. And I was like, this movie sucks. And I walked into it, which is so weird. It's weird to walk into stores for not the sole, like, to not even shop. You're there for an entirely different reason that has nothing to do with the store at all, and have everybody look at you because you just wander around and like you're not buying anything. And it's absolutely like, this is going to sound brutal, so cover your ears. But it's absolutely gutted. You can't really tell that it was ever a theater. There's like an outline, because it's brick inside. There's like an outline where a screen was. But yeah, there's like nothing really there that you would not be able to walk into it and be like, this was a theater. Which is actually kind of makes me sad. And the last theater that I kind of am going to talk about and that I saw, although I saw a lot more, but Meredith will talk about that later, the United Artists Theater. And it opened in December 26, 1927 with My Best Girl, a silent film starring Mary Pickford and Buddy Rogers, and a prologue and several shorts preceded the feature. It closed in 1989. The reopening of the office building as a hotel was in January 2014. So it's now called, it's like Theater at Ace Hotel is what it's called now, even though the United Artists marquee is like still up and looks really beautiful. And you can like look in and you can see like a lot of the original interior to some extent is still there. And it's really beautiful. I really wish I could go inside. I don't know what still remains exactly, because that one was actually like closed. But I think it's been, you know, it's a hotel now, but most of these theaters seem to become churches at some point. So I wouldn't be surprised at some point in its history if it became a church, or it was, you know, used for services. But that's kind of what I saw on my small tour. And I hope someday with the LA Conservancy that I can take my own tour. And, Meredith, I'm going to pass it to you and you can talk about what your theaters are.
Okay. Yeah. So, and also I want to just add on that I really want to do the LA Conservancy, the walking tour as well. That is a goal, and I'm going to do my best to do that in the future. So
great. I'm doing on November 7th, I think I'm doing the Art Deco walking tour, which is like downtown. It's like Art Deco downtown.
That sounds amazing. That's one of my, not to get off top, well, I'm going to get a little off topic for a minute, but I am excited to hear about how that goes. And I would like to do that in the future if that's a regular thing as well, because Art Deco is like one of the many loves of my life. And that sounds incredible. That's one of my favorite things overall about Los Angeles is how many Art Deco buildings there are, and that's just something that I love seeing out there. So that sounds really fun. I hope you enjoy that.
Yeah, I'll take pictures for you.
Yes. Okay. All right. So the first theater that I'm going to talk about, and mine of course are also the all three theaters that I'm covering are on Broadway in Los Angeles, like I mentioned earlier. But the first one that I'm going to discuss is the Orpheum Theater. So the Orpheum was opened in February 1926 as a vaudeville theater. And vaudeville, and then obviously it changed to a movie house. But actress Ruth Chatterton topped the bill, appearing in a stage presentation of The Conflict. Also on the bill were British comics Nervo and Knox, and the latest Pathé News was shown on screen. It was the fourth and final Orpheum Theater to be opened in downtown Los Angeles. So the one I'm talking about is the one that is still exists to this day under the same name. It was decorated in a French Renaissance style. And originally it was reported to have 2,350 seats. It was, and here's a quote that I ended up pulling. It says, it opened as a 2-day vaudeville house and featured top stars of the day, and it was one of the most lavish theaters on the Orpheum circuit. Just over 2 years after the theater was open, a Wurlitzer 3-manual 13-ranks organ was installed. I just wanted to add that really quick, because if you know me, you probably know that I have a thing for theater organs in general, but the Wurlitzers, like the Mighty Wurlitzer, is like one of my favorite things in the whole world. I love those. And you mentioned like live accompaniment. Of course, those were used for silent film accompaniment, and those are so cool to hear. So I just wanted to add that. And there's just a note that says later, a post horn was added to the organ, making 14 ranks. The theater was operated by Radio Keith Orpheum, RKO, from 1929, and full-time vaudeville was discontinued when the theater was equipped for showing movies to supplement vaudeville acts on the stage. A projection booth was installed at the rear of the balcony at this time. On December 25th, 1929, the world premiere of the RKO movie Hit the Deck, starring Jack Oakey, was held at the Orpheum. But the Depression, of course, was starting to hit deeply, and the theater closed down in 1932.
the quote-unquote dark theater was taken over by Cheryl Corwin in September 33, and his dream was to present high-class stage shows with movies. So the company he formed was the Metropolitan Theaters, who basically operated the theater until 1964. Also, I meant to mention this earlier, but the original marquee that had been installed was taken down in 1941, and the spectacular neon-lit marquee we see today was installed at that time. Also, in the early days of the Orpheum, Jack Benny, the iconic Jack Benny, was the MC of stage shows, which attracted such stars as Eddie Cantor, Will Rogers, Burns and Allen, the Marx Brothers, Edgar Bergen, Red Skeleton, Josephine Baker, Lena Horne, and like a lot of other people, big bands of the 1940s, et cetera, et cetera. During this period, special star nights were a popular event every Monday evening when a star of the feature film that was showed was introduced to the audience from the star box at the side of the proscenium. The
That's
stage show.
Cool.
Isn't it? I know. I'm like, that's a really good draw to get people there.
I know. Like, I've never experienced anything like that.
I know.
I also have to say that Jack Benny is a way better host than what the Warner Brothers downtown Pantages had. Their opening night, they had two of, like, the worst guests you could have. They had Al Jolson and Frank Fay. I'm serious. Like... It was weird.
Yeah, you could not catch me there.
I know, I was like, I'll skip out. Frank Fay was the MC the whole night. I think that when I was there, I was like, holy shit, Frank Fay stood right here. No, I just...
You're like, I gotta clean myself off.
I know, I'm like, ew.
That sounds terrible, but like...
Al Jolson did Mammy right here.
Ugh, I'm like...
stage.
No. Yeah, no, it's not good. I maybe would have gone if Ruby Keeler was in attendance. Like, I don't know, depending on what, I don't know what, can't remember what year that was. Like, they were married, Ruby Keeler married Al Jolson in 1928, so I don't know if they were a thing yet or not, depending on when the opening was. So,
I think he was there, like, it was 1920, so they were definitely probably not married. I don't know when they got married, I can't remember.
Yeah, they were married. I'm almost certain it was 1928. And see, Ruby was like way younger than him. I think she was born in 1910 or 11. So she's kind of itty bitty at that point, 1920. So, okay.
Yeah, she was like probably like a teenager, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh,
or
yeah.
20, I guess. 20. Yeah, no, this was before Ruby.
Okay. Well, then, yeah, definitely. Probably would have stayed home that night or gone to another place. So as I say, the whole Star Night thing, that is really cool. In the stage show and movie policy lasted until 1952, when stage shows were dropped in favor of double feature movies. The 17-piece orchestra that would often accompany the movies was made redundant, of course, for silent films, I should say. And the Wurlitzer organ was rarely used and eventually became unplayable, which that is the saddest part, I think, of this whole thing that I have to read. Because, again, I just want to save Wurlitzer organs as much as I can. And I was going to say there's one at the Fox Theater in St. Louis, which I'm, side note, planning on finishing a piece on. I was thinking about talking about that, but I was like, no, that's off topic for LA theaters. But the Fox Theater in St. Louis is one of my favorite places that I've ever been to. It is so gorgeous. And I've heard the Wurlitzer. And if you were in the area, anywhere in Missouri or wherever, and ever gets there and haven't been there before, please go to like a tour on a Saturday morning. They're like $10. And a lot of times they'll play the organ. So just going to give them a shout out. It's way off topic, but, you know, anyway. So now the Orpheum actually remains a live entertainment and movie theater. Also, it's a location that like many movies have filmed at. So you probably have seen it in a ton of movies. So the Orpheum holds a special place in my heart because it's actually the one movie theater in downtown LA, like Broadway specifically, that I have been to so far. And I was very lucky and able to go during the summer of, I believe it was 2014. And it was actually a part of the LA Conservancy's Last Remaining Seats program, which is, I believe it goes through all summer. They play a handful of classic films on certain nights during the summer. And it's a really incredible program. And so my family, we actually went out there to LA for our vacation. And so I happened to look ahead and was like, hey, they're doing Footlight Parade at the Orpheum. And I was like, can we do this? And so anyway, we got tickets and it was so cool. Like, it just going into the Orpheum, genuinely one of the most beautiful places I have ever seen. And I want to go back so bad. And of course, like, I had seen Footlight Parade before, and so I was like, oh, I'm really excited to see this on the big screen, because it's one of those movies, and you know this as well, Amelia, like, it's one of those movies that is, like, just, like, begs to be seen on the big screen, because, of course, it's a Busby Berkeley musical, and I know we both bond over our love of Busby Berkeley Depression-era pre-code musicals, and so, personally, I typically say, like, my favorite, like, Busby Berkeley musical number is By a Waterfall. And so I was so excited to see that. It was also on 35mm. So I was like, bonus points. It's on film. And seeing By a Waterfall on the big screen on 35 was so cool. And, you know, I want to say I would love to see it again. You know, if I'm lucky, I already got to do it once. I don't want to be like, oh, I want to do it again. It's, you know, like, I have to, but you know, it's just like, once you see something like that, it definitely kind of spoils you, in the best kind of way. Like, it's a really nice experience, and it just makes you realize how cool it is to see old movies on the big screen, especially somewhere with such a rich history. And you really do feel like you are in an incredibly fancy place, and you feel like you're stepping back in time when you go into a place like the Orpheum. Like, they have kept it so well. It's just so well kept. And it's one of those places that even, like, walking in a hallway and, like, going to into the bathrooms is, like, an experience, because you're like, oh, my God, the signs, these old signs, they're so pretty. Or the chandeliers, you know, you're looking up and you see all of the decorations and everything. And it was truly an incredible experience. And I was really grateful to do that. So I did want to just add my little personal story with that. And I'm going to tweet in this week. I've got some photos that I had posted on Facebook from that night, just to give a little bit of an insight on that. So anyway, with that being said, my second theater is the State Theater, which opened in November of 1921 with a vaudeville show and the premiere of the film A Trip to Paradise. Now, this is a quote I pulled from the Los Angeles Historic Theater Foundation. It opened as Lowe's State in November 1921. The theater was Lowe's West Coast Showcase Movie Palace, later becoming the downtown Los Angeles home for first-run MGM movies. It is the largest theater on Broadway by audience capacity, originally reported as 2,450 seats. It's a 12-story Beaux-Arts-style structure with a brick facade, one of the largest brick-clad buildings in the city, with terracotta ornamentation at the lower levels. And the interior design of the theater references a Spanish castle with distressed stencil work on the plaster ceilings of the lobby and auditorium appearing as wood. And basically, it was, of course, an MGM, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Theater. And with its strategic Broadway and 7th Street corner location, it was intersected by busy streetcars, so it was a consistent moneymaker. Now, in the 1930s, the theater changed ownership, and then operation of the theater was turned over to United Artists again in 1949, and the theater's name changed to the State Theater, as it is known now. In early 1963, the state was acquired by Metropolitan Theaters and subsequently featured many general release movies dubbed into Spanish. The Metropolitan Theaters closed the state in 1997. And then in 98, the theater was leased by the church group Cathedral of Faith, who occupied the theater for 20 years. Oh, and also, just to backtrack really quick, by the 1960s, I mentioned a lot of the movies were dubbed into Spanish, but they were actually showing first-run Spanish-language films as well. And then the theater closed its doors in the 90s, reopening in the mid-2000s as the Universal Church of Christ. And now the state is owned by the Broadway Theater Group, who also own the Palace, the Los Angeles, and Tower Theaters, all on Broadway in downtown LA. And then a little note that I wanted to add, which this is another pulled quote from the Los Angeles Historic Theater Foundation, but I did want to mention this, and you, Amelia, will understand why I wanted to say it, because it's just a little note that I like. In 1929, a Bakersfield act called the Gum Sisters played at the state, featuring a lead singer who earned the nickname Leather Lungs for her ability to be heard clearly at the rear of the 125-foot deep auditorium. As the Great Depression took hold and vaudeville declined, vaudeville ceased at the state in the mid-30s, the Gum Sisters moved to Culver City to appear in experimental Technicolor musicals, and Leather Lungs changed her name to Judy Garland. So I actually picked the state because I saw a note like early on about how Judy and her sisters appeared there when they were young. What'd you say?
Judy.
I want to go off into the Ann Miller thing every time you say that.
It's a good bit.
It is a good bit. I need to get that down pat at some point so I can do the whole thing, and I'll like do a dramatic reading of it on the podcast, and nobody like will understand it.
Oh my god, that would be amazing if you did that.
Okay, that's my goal. I'm gonna try to do my best old Ann Miller impression. Well, old guys doing old Ann Miller impression, because that's, I forget that the guy, like, two guys voice them in those videos, so. Yes. Okay, and then my third theater of the day is the Million Dollar Theater, which, like, what a name, honestly. It's a great name. So the Million Dollar Theater was created for the theater impresario Sid Grauman as his first Los Angeles venue. The Million Dollar Theater was one of the earliest and largest movie palaces in the country, boasting 2,345 seats. And it was one of the first movie palaces to exist. It opened in 1918 with the premiere of The Silent Man, accompanied by a 30-piece orchestra. Guests included Douglas Fairbanks Sr., Mary Pickford, and Charlie Chaplin. The massive 110-foot-wide balcony in the auditorium was a feat of engineering. It was supported by the world's first reinforced concrete girder, developed because of a shortage of structural steel during World War I. Now, in the 1940s, the Million Dollar Theater hosted jazz and big band stars such as Billie Holiday, Artie Shaw, and Lionel Hampton. And then in the 50s, the theater became the first theater on Broadway to feature Spanish language variety shows, including headline acts from Mexico City and Latin America. The theater served as a leading Latinx entertainment venue for decades, featuring I want to make sure I say this correctly. It's basically variety shows in Spanish, veridades, and Mexican film premieres. And if I mispronounce that, I was trying to make sure I did that right, but please someone correct me if I did that wrong. The lobby has been dramatically altered, and the ceiling was lowered, and its walls were covered, which, okay, that might be the most depressing thing I've read so far today. I'm gonna say that. Yet much of the lobby's original ceiling and murals depicting the king of the Golden River fairy tale remain intact behind the drop ceiling and walls. So basically what we need to be doing is going in and being like, yo, knock down those drop ceilings and walls and let's get the original stuff out. Come on, let's do this.
Literally, I would do it. Don't just tempt me like that.
I know. That sounds like a good time, honestly. It's like, we're going to be like, I don't know, just, I was going to say renegade, but I don't know if that's the right word, but just like going in and doing badass things and, you know, restoring theaters. So, like, that's
fucking
our
excavating.
Yeah, that's our superpower.
I wish.
I know, that's the same here. So the Million Dollar Theater basically has served as a church as well, which again is a very often recurring theme, as you mentioned before, Amelia. Now, after it served as a church, the Million Dollar Theater was closed to the public, and then it reopened for performances and special events in 2008 after a year-long refurbishment, and now serves as an event and filming location. So I feel like at least it's being used, and it's used, being used for film and event purposes. So it's like, okay, it's cool. But yeah, so I think it's very, I don't know, all of those different theaters. It's very interesting, I think, how there are a lot of similarities. Like, you, like, again, we like literally were just talking about how a lot of them have been churches at one point, or a lot of, you know, this like, films that were run in Spanish, you know, a lot of those and whatnot. Like, that's, I think that's a really cool thing, and a lot of those again have those, that in common. But yeah, did you have any other thoughts? I wanted to like turn it back to you if you had any other thoughts about these theaters or anything history wise or whatnot.
You know, this just makes me want to burst through the gates even more. I guess I would like to give a honorable mention to some of the other theaters that I passed by, like, along my walk, because, you know, I actually don't remember seeing the Million Dollar Theater on my walk. Maybe I did. There was, like, you know, I just was, like, in awe the entire time. But along with the theaters we mentioned, I also saw, and I'm trying to find the thread real quick. It's been a hot second. So the other theaters are the Palace Theater. Oh, wait, you talked about that. That's the Orpheum. Boo! The Globe is one we didn't talk about. And it has its original marquee. It has, like, a globe on the marquee. And I'm like, ooh. It is basically just a nightclub. It looks like you could go there if you want to go to a rave. I was like, this is for ravers. The Tower Theater. And those are the two ones I think we didn't mention. And the funny thing about the Orpheum is that, or I don't think it was the Orpheum, but one of the theaters has like an outline of like a usher with a light, like a flashlight. I don't remember which theater it is, but you can like peek into the gate and you see this like one like design or illustration of an usher staring at you. It kind of gave me the creeps, honestly. Old things that are shut down give me the creeps. I don't know what it is, but I was getting some heebie-jeebies.
Yeah, you know what's an interesting thing? There are some accounts that I follow on social media, like, is it, there's one called, is it, I think it's Abandoned, it's like Abandoned America. No, hold on a second. Let's see if I can like find that. But anyway, but what I'm trying to say is I follow some accounts online, specifically Twitter and then YouTube, of people who go in and either take photos or record footage of abandoned buildings. And some people go and explore like old movie theaters. And I think that it's like, it's a combination of, it's really sad, and I'm sure it kind of feels creepy, like, at least for some people. But then also, I think it's very fascinating as well. And I still want to see, like, I still, like, am very curious. I'm like, what does it look like? And, you know, try to, like, imagine what it could have, like, what it did look like and what it could look like. And so I think that's, like, endlessly fascinating. And, like I said, there are definitely people online who are posting that content. So, yeah, I'm just trying to remember, like, what, who, I can't remember who it is that posts, but I'll try to remember to give them a shout out online when I figure that out, because there's definitely some good content there.
I personally love watching those videos on YouTube, especially when they're going into theaters, But I get so jealous. It's like I have to turn it off.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm like, I wish that were me. Why is that not me? Look at the projectors. Oh my God, I would just like be hauling equipment out. Mm-hmm. I know that's like illegal because that's trespassing and like technically stealing. But like if it's just sitting there dusty, it makes me really sad. And there's like so many different opportunities to like use this. There's like someone could use that equipment for parts or like something. You know, I just hate to see it all be thrown away. And I hope that some of the theaters that we kind of talked about that aren't really theaters anymore, I just wish like one day, or I hope one day, that they become theaters again. I'm highly doubtful of that, but I think just like with some organizations backing them and like some fundraisers and stuff, it could totally happen. And it would be really great.
That would be. I know if I had a lot of money, that's one of the things I would do is just go and like try to restore the old movie theaters and you know, get like those revitalized. And so, yeah, I'm exactly with you on that too. Like, it's, you know, open them back up if you can. Like, let's get them back because they're in their full glory. They're amazing.
And I just want to go into those booths. Let me in. I always feel really stupid, but every time I go in like a theater, I'm like, I don't want to be annoying, but I'm like, can you let me in your booth? Can I see your booth? Please.
Yep.
Please. Like, it's sad, but I just like, that is my first inclination. That's like the first thing I want to do. I was wondering if you'd be down to talk about some of our promos.
All right, so yeah, first off, Warner Archive is releasing The Pirate and Libeled Lady on Blu-ray. That's going to come out sometime in November, so be on the lookout for that if you're a fan of those movies. Also, the book Cary Grant, A Brilliant Disguise by Scott Eyman has been released recently. I have yet to read it, but I am planning on doing that as soon as I can. I have heard some great things about it, and so I did want to include that on promos, because if you are a fan of Cary Grant, it sounds like it is well worth a read. So definitely check that out if you would like to. Amelia, I'm going to throw it back to you for a couple of our other promos.
Yeah, so again, I mentioned this in our last podcast, but there's a fundraiser for the Famous Players Orchestra from October 30th to 31st. They're streaming Phantom of the Opera, and it's going to have a musical score performed by Scott Lasky. Scott's really great. And they're just a really great group that does a lot of silent film screenings. They do them in Burbank. Right now, they can't do them, obviously, because no one's allowed to have theaters open. But if you could please consider donating to them, they're really great. And also watch The Phantom of the Opera, which is also an equally great film. The showtimes for that are going to be on fporchestra.org. And so check your latest showtimes and listings on their website. And I also wanted to include this promo that I just learned about today. So Retro Format Silent Films Los Angeles is going to be teaming up with Cartoons on Film, which Cartoons on Film does the Cartoon Carnival, which I rant and rave about because it's so great. And they're doing a vintage Halloween animation night tomorrow night, streaming on Facebook. It's going to be free and includes a Zoom interview with a mutual that I follow, who does the Cartoon Carnival, Tommy Jose. So please join that. It's going to be a lot of fun. It has Felix the Cat, Coco the Clown, Mutt and Jeff, and Pete the Pup. And it is so much fun to watch old cartoons. And I'm really looking forward to it. And the Silent Film Watch Party, again, is going to be doing some screenings. I talked about some of these screenings.
It's appropriate these, for like Halloween.
Okay. I know, some of these screamings. There's going to be some screenings coming up. Yesterday they did The Mark of Zorro and it sounded like a really great screening. And I think actually that that's like all they have. They don't have any other shows, I guess. That's funny. Never mind. That's it. Never mind. I have to say, like, I really wish, and I don't know, you know, Meredith, I know you don't have TCM right now, but it's so odd because their Halloween programming, maybe I just haven't been paying attention, and I know they can't show Halloween films, like, every night, but it's like they don't play Halloween films during the day at all, or even at night, really. Like, it's, they don't come on until, like, 10, 11 o'clock at night, you know, Pacific time. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if it's because, like, they're not classy films, and so, like, maybe they want to show quote-unquote classier films during the day. But, like, even on Halloween, it's like I'm, like, somewhat disappointed in their lineup. Last night I watched their Werewolf 1956, which was really great, and Ninja 3, the I have to remember the title. I think it was Ninja 3, The Domination, which was a really fucking crazy movie. And I just want to say shout out to Millie for programming Ninja 3, The Domination, which I stayed up literally until like 2 a.m. watching. And tonight I'm going to be watching, I don't want to butcher the name, Haxan, H-A-X-A-N. I've been wanting to watch that for a long time. It's Silent Film Sundays. But yeah, I don't know if you noticed that. They don't really play, like, during October, they don't play horror movies, like, frequently during the day. They always play them so early until, like, 7 a.m. in the morning, and then they're, like, done with the programming. So I always miss them.
Hmm. That's interesting. Yeah, I don't know. But TCM, we need answers now.
I know. I'm going to complain on your Facebook page, your Twitter page. I will not stop. No, I'm just kidding. No, it's just interesting. I'm like, is that because they want to, like, appear classy? And are, like, I guess horror films sometimes aren't, you know, called, like, they're just not perceived as classy or, like, classic film. You know, it's like, I don't know. Speculating.
Yeah, but you could be like the anti how do I put this, like, the anti-normal complainer on TCM's social media, especially if you like Facebook and then sometimes Twitter. But, you know, instead of being like the normal, you know, people, like, we talked about on other episodes where it's like John Waters, ew, Jay-Z, ew, but you could be like, we could be like the opposite, where it's like every day. Well, that would just be harassment, I guess, if you did this. But I was going to say, like, every single day, just, like, comment on every post and be like, where the hell is the John Waters marathon? Like, when are we going to get more John Waters? But then, like, again, yeah, don't do that, because that's harassment. But
I kind of was, like, when I was watching some of the films, like, last night that were horror films, because I watched, like I said, The Werewolf and then The Howling, I was like, man, I kind of would be down if they, like, programmed horror films like frequently and not just for October. I'd be like, mm-hmm. So down for that.
Yeah, I feel like maybe horror movies get a bad rap because, and this is again the word I will use is speculation, because that was a great word and I feel that right now. It's speculation to me, but I feel like maybe horror films sometimes don't get taken as seriously because of the nature of them, you know. So it's, I mean, sometimes how, like, you know, it feels like with award shows and comedies where it's like, you know, I don't know if people just think those are throwaways, but it's actually like a better, like, it's a really interesting and cool craft. And I think a lot of people just don't appreciate it as much. And I, like, okay, I'm onto something here. I just can't really articulate it very well. But, like, I just, horror, which, by the way, suck it. I try to say horror, and it sounds like another word. So I hope that it's clear what I'm saying, I think. But, you know, like, it's just, I feel like they sometimes don't get enough appreciation from,
So I guess some people, because obviously it's a lot of people do love and appreciate horror. So I don't want to say that like it's extremely underappreciated, but I think just in some areas, it's definitely like maybe it's not seen as like legitimate entertainment, you know, compared to like a drama, a straight drama or something. So yeah, it's a very interesting point you bring up though. So I don't know, but I'm all for horror programming too. I think that there's a lot of good scary movies, and I don't know about you, but I kind of feel like I've just kind of started, I've like scratched the surface of watching scary movies, and so I have a lot to discover, which is like an exciting thought to me that I could like and there's so many subgenres too of you know, like the psychological or I don't like to do a lot of the gory stuff, but there are ones like slashers that I do like sometimes, you know, or like the different eras, which we probably talked about, like for me personally, the 70s I think mm-hmm. is the greatest decade for scary movies, at least from what I've seen. That's just my personal favorite. So I think there's just, yeah, there's so many the eras and the subgenres that, you know, you can really go for. A video, like video nasties. I have a friend online who,
oh my God, yeah.
Yeah, like you get introduced to this stuff and it's so cool because you're like, whoa, I never knew this was a thing, or I have never seen this. And, you know, it's so cool, like all the different avenues that you can go down from seeing things that are maybe odd or absurd and just go down rabbit holes of like really interesting and sometimes bad, but like they're usually bad in a really entertaining way. So yeah, I just wanted to add to that. Just I have some thoughts about scary movies.
If you don't like gory films, I guess we won't be watching Necromantic 2 together.
I do want to watch that. I do. I can like tolerate them.
I don't know, Meredith. Yeah. I'm just saying. I've watched it like 4 times at this point. And if you don't like gore, I'm just going to say like you're going to be covering your eyes for some of it.
I still feel like it seems worth it to watch. So, we'll see. I might challenge myself to do it and we'll see how that goes.
I mean, it's not like super high on the gore list, but there's definitely like big scenes where it happens. Also, if you don't like the idea of like, you know, sex and dead bodies, it's definitely not for you. the special effects, the practical effects in that film are what's really the thing that really like gets under my skin, because it's just so real. Like I'm like, man, this is gross and grimy, but I really love it, and I cannot get any of my friends to watch it with me.
I think I'll watch it with you.
Yeah, let's have a screening.
Okay, let's do it. I'm excited.
It's only going to be like my 6th time watching it. It sounds really terrible when I say that, because I'm like, what kind of person am I if I've seen Necromantic 2 6 times? I haven't even seen the first one. The second one's better. The second one's better.
All right. Well, thank you guys so much for once again joining us on this episode. We hope you enjoyed listening to us talk about some of the theaters in Los Angeles and why, you know, preservation of these old theaters is so important to us and why we're passionate about it. So with that being said, of course, if you do not follow us on social media and you are on social media, we are on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. If you look us up under the Goldwyn Girls, you will find us. We are especially active on Twitter and Instagram, where we post different polls and lots of different photos and some fun content. So definitely check us out there if you'd like. And also, of course, you know, can listen to us at your preferred platform. You know, if you enjoy our show, please give us a good rating and a review if you are so willing to do so. We very much appreciate everyone and the support that we get. We thank you so much, and we look forward to being back with you next time. With that being said, have a wonderful week, and bye.
Goodbye.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby.
Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat. The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars and the candy. So let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.